plate with the bases loaded, two down, the pitch. Curveball, swinging a tap foul, and the Cardinals are one strike away from going to Detroit and the 2006 World Series. Adam Wainwright gets a new baseball. Rubs it up, stands on, looks in with the bases loaded, two out. Cardinals leading 3-1 here in the bottom of the ninth inning. One of the most dangerous hitters in the business at the plate, Carlos Beltran. He is ready. So is Wainwright. The 0-2 delivery. Curve struck him out looking. The Cardinals are going to Michigan to take on the Tigers. They mob Adam Wainwright on the mound. They are National League champions and headed for Detroit as they mob the pitcher. And now Yadier Molina. In comes the bullpenners to pile on. The Cardinals have won this game 3-1.
1-2 to Castillo. Wright still very close to the line at third. Runner leads from first. The 1-2 pitch. Swing and a ground ball to short to his left. Reyes, he's got it. Flips to second and put it in the books. Force play retires Randa at second. And the Mets have come from behind to defeat the Pittsburgh Pirates 7-6. Here at Shea Stadium and make it a happy 4th of July for Mets fans. In the ninth inning for Pittsburgh, no runs, one hit, no errors, one left. Billy Wagner picks up the save, and the Mets have defeated the Pirates 7-6, and it's a milestone save for Billy. His 300th Major League save, all but 16 of them now, for either the Houston Astros or the Philadelphia Phillies. But congratulations to Billy Wagner. He gets a hug from Julio Franco, and the Mets have won it to even the series 7-6 this afternoon.
We're back, and joining me, blast from the past. You guys may remember him from the Daily News as well as ESPN New York, Mets beat reporter. Who better to talk about Carlos Beltran and Billy Wagner up for the Hall of Fame than Adam Rubin? Adam, maybe there's some younger fans that don't remember you, but we will educate them. You probably don't remember this. I've been doing some form of independent media since 2007. WGBB Long Island, you were my first guest on my first show. Opening day 07, day after, was my first show. You were my first guest. I was nervous as anything because the great Adam Rubin was coming on my show, and I don't want to mess it up. So welcome to the program. I hope I do a better job by today, because if I listen back to my first iteration, I was awful. So welcome to the program. How you doing?
Thank you. I'll flatter you as well that my mother was a religious listener of WGBB when I was younger.
Wow. That makes me really old or really...
not that anyone wants to hear this, but was there someone on there, Craig Mustard maybe? And I'm trying to remember all the other names from back then.
Oh, yeah. WGBB. Yeah, for sure. So... Hey, so we're bringing you back on. I know you work for LAU Athletics, assistant associate athletic director. Is that what I would say?
I oversee the game broadcast, the social media, the website content for the athletic department. Official title is associate athletic director for media relations. But basically, a lot of the stuff I did content creation-wise with the Mets, but obviously with a different tone now because I'm covering it on behalf of the team as opposed to covering a team with an independent media company.
Yeah, so... Do you miss it? So here's what the fans don't get. You were a beat writer. Sounds glamorous. You get to talk to Hall of Famers. You get to watch baseball for free. But they forget it is a job. You got deadlines. You've got the same West Coast trip that the athletes do. You're at the ballpark till midnight, just like the athletes. You're living out of a suitcase, the hotel, the whole nine yards. Do you miss it at all?
I do miss some aspects of it, and I wouldn't rule out someday maybe getting back into it even. But I was the beat reporter for 15 years covering the Mets, first for the Daily News, as you mentioned, and then ESPN. And during that time, I was on the road 170 days a year, which it's a little excessive, obviously. And the thing that got really difficult was not so much the travel, even though that's obviously kind of arduous and kind of wears you down a little bit. It was more obviously as the internet and social media became the more and more prevalent form of communication over the just whether it was in the newspaper or not. It got to be where it was every second of every day where, yeah, you want to break a story. And if you do break a story, everyone else will catch up a minute later. But the flip side is you could catch up a minute later also if someone else breaks a story. But that means you have to be looking at your phone nonstop to see what everyone else is reporting nonstop. So I actually remember I had a little detox from looking at my phone. It took me a while when I got off the beat.
Do you watch, I mean, and I'll get to Beltran and Wagner, but are you a baseball fan? I know you're into college athletics now, it's your job, but are you a baseball fan? Are you into watching the Mets, or are you so much like, hey, I live that firsthand that you almost, kind of like when I talk to former athletes, they're like, you know, I really don't watch the game that much anymore.
Yeah, well, I do follow all the beat reporters or most of the beat reporters, at least the guys who were around when I was around on Twitter. So I have a pretty good handle on the Mets, although if you started quizzing me, I'd probably flunk. But I have a pretty good handle on the Mets just because I follow the guys. I don't religiously watch the games on TV or anything at this point. A lot of it because of the reason you cited, but also because we have 38 sports at Long Island University and keeps me on my toes and keeps me busy. I, the year I did get off the beat, I did write a lot for SNY's website and also did some stuff at New York Post. This past season, I was at Citi Field once to cover a Mets-Phillies game for MLB.com. And I think I'll probably do a little bit more this upcoming summer for MLB.com. But the baseball I follow these days is kind of college baseball. When I was at NYIT, where I started in college athletics, I got an opportunity to hire Frank Catalanato as the baseball coach to the D2 College World Series our first year. Now at Hofstra, did a remarkable job this past year there as well. And our LIU baseball team this past year made the NCAA tournament just like Hofstra and got to go to the Maryland Regional. So it's been a tremendous amount of fun doing the college baseball and being basically on the team side, going on the trips with the team, not flying commercially separately and stuff like that.
So here you hire Frank Catalanato after you covered him for, what, a half a season, I think, with the Mets in, what, 2009 or 2008, whenever he was with the team. So must be a little weird on that one, right?
Yeah, I still have – we're still good friends now. We laugh about it, but I had covered him that half season or whatever before he got released with the Mets and I think retired right after that. And I DM'd him, this was 6 years ago now, on Twitter. I hadn't spoke to him for several years or not really had spoken to him. And just said, hey, if we had a job opening at NYT for baseball coach, would you be interested? And he said, well, let's talk. Well, after he didn't get back to me for a day, he got back to me and said, let's talk about it. And it was magic from the start. As I said, year one as a college coach took us to the D2 College World Series. The amount of teaching he did just during fall ball before they even got to the spring was incredible. And those kids really benefit from it. The Hofstra guys are benefiting from it right now. So he did a tremendous, tremendous job. He's going to be he's going to be a big time college coach and at an SEC school if he wants to. I know he has ties to Long Island, so that may not be in the immediate plans, but or if he wants to get into the pro ranks, he'll be a successful coach no matter where he is.
So I showed this to you before we got on the air. Pedro Carlson Omar, you are an author. And, you know, that's why I brought you on, because I think, you know, the Carlos Beltran story, he's, as of you know, as our conversation here, he's got about, according to, you know, some of the ballot counters, about 56% of the vote. Billy Wagner, almost there, about 72.5%. You covered these guys, you know, Beltran specifically, and I know you wrote a book about it, and I don't know how much you remember about that winter of 04 into 05, but Beltran, I think, is an interesting case, not just because of his overall resume. I don't think he's really appreciated by Mets fans, mainly because of 06, because of the strikeout. There was the injuries. There was the controversy with the front office. And you covered him. You know, it's funny, when he was named Mets manager, I said to myself, it's not the guy. Now, I didn't cover him like you, but, you know, you get a feel of someone when you watch them, like, that's not the guy I thought would ever be a manager. You know, you never got that feel. And I'm curious, you know, now that you can look back, you're a guys that are up for election Hall of Fame. Sometimes covering players, you get this is a Hall of Famer. There's that gut feel. Forget about the numbers. And I'm curious your thoughts on that. As you now see Beltran years later, his arc, his narrative, all the stuff that happened and how you would vote if you had a vote, if you want to share that.
Well, yeah, no, I make my vote public every year. And I voted both for Beltran and for Billy Wagner this year. Billy Wagner hadn't previously been on my ballot. Primarily because I didn't have space. I know closers are a little, there's some debate about some closers, but I voted for Trevor Hoffman too, many moons ago. And you touched on so many points with respect to Beltran, the lack of respect from Met fans. And I think it kind of maybe had a boomerang back well after his retirement. But I mean, I just think about with Beltran just changing the culture of the Mets. And that, if you remember that 2004 season was the last one under Art Howe. It was a pretty dismal season, 71 and 91. The Mets payroll that year was $87 million, which you think about what Steve Cohen is doing now, I think about an $87 million payroll. I know we're talking about nearly 20 years ago, but $87 million in New York then was exceedingly low too.
Yep.
And then Omar Minaya comes in as GM. Jim Duquette kind of gets blindsided or pushed aside a little bit. The Wolpons decide to open up the pocketbooks a little bit. They bring in Pedro Martinez and Carlos Beltran. They try to get Carlos Delgado that winter too. He goes to the Marlins, but ends up with the Mets a year later in a trade when Marlins had one of their kind of classic fire sales anyway. And it was magic. I don't want to say magic right from the beginning, because they started off, if you remember, 0-5 that year. Beltran homers on opening day. Pedro has a great performance on the mound, and then Braden Looper, their stopgap closer, blows the save. They go 0-5. I still remember, not to digress too much, but Willie Randolph, Mike Piazza had given Willie Randolph, the first year manager in 2005, a cigar to smoke after his first win. He gave it to him before the season started. They start off 0-5, and here they are, the last game in Atlanta before they come home as the, what they had been branded as kind of the new Mets. And so they're about to go home 0-6, and Beltran homers, I think in the eighth inning or so, off John Smoltz, who's having a terrific game. So they come back 1-5, and but they really did well that year. As it's 71-91 the previous year, and then 83-79, which was, so it's a 12-game improvement in 2005, and kind of faded late, but they were in the wild card race, I think, it's until a trip to St. Louis in September. So it was really a magical season, and it really set up 2006. And you hit so many points about Beltran. I mean, for instance, everyone's going to remember that curveball from Adam Wainwright with the bases loaded in game seven of the NLCS. But if you think about even just that series, he had three home runs and eight RBIs that series, at 296 that series. And and then you brought up something else about, you didn't really foresee him being the manager of the Mets. And I was off the beat by the time they made that decision. That, I guess, obviously was ill-fated because of what happened, what came out with the Astros. But Beltran was very much an introvert with the Mets, didn't love the publicity. If you remember, in that 2006 season early on, he starts out 0-9 that year, and he's getting booed by the fans, and then he hits a home run.
Yeah.
And fans are
chanting. Julio Franco had to push him out of the dugout. Exactly. People don't remember that. I remember that very vividly. That was a big deal. That was a turning point maybe for him at that point.
Yeah, and at the time after the game, he said, hey, and he was obviously, the fans had obviously gotten under his skin, because he said, I'm a friend when things are going good and going bad. And he was kind of getting on the fans for getting on him for being booed. So he was an introvert from and I don't think he really loved being the spokesperson. I mean, to kind of tie Billy Wagner and Carlos Beltran together for a second, I mean, you may recall that Billy Wagner and Paul Luca, to a lesser extent, groused about having to do so much media duty because Beltran didn't love the spotlight, and Carlos Delgado was kind of a ghost after games.
Sure.
Probably Beltran took a little bit of a cue from Delgado, not the leader of that. In fact, David Wright early in his career had to have an inordinate amount of burden of answering questions because Beltran and Delgado and Luis Castillo weren't really available at the same rate as some of the other guys. So there are so many things that I recall about those teams, and that's why it really surprised me. And the other thing that surprised me about when Beltran was selected as the Mets manager was that there was a lot of friction with the Wolpons and the front office. He had that microfracture surgery in January of 2010, I want to say it was, and the Mets came out publicly, which would be unheard. It's not exactly PR 101. To come out publicly and say he did it without our permission, which created a lot of friction between Scott Boras and Carlos Beltran and the Mets. So to turn around less than later and anointed the manager after all that bad blood was really surprising to me.
It's crazy to think those times, you know, they had the 3-year run. 06 was like the perfect season. You know, Beltran's like top five at MVP, 40 home runs. Even with all the injuries and the weird stuff, nothing really went wrong. Everything went right until game seven. And I still remember, I mean, in WFAN and Benigno to this day, you know, he's not clutch. And I'm saying to myself, and I've watched that at bat a few times, and that curveball he couldn't hit. He couldn't hit. I mean, that, let's face it, Adam Wainwright's probably a Hall of Famer. So he lost, he got beat by a Hall of Famer. You want to say where he lost in that at bat, and this is hindsight 2020, and I can see it now. Bases loaded, you know, Wainwright's stress. Tony La Russa even admitted that, I think, years later. Fastball down the middle, that's when you pounce, first pitch. But Beltran was a thinking man's hitter, and maybe he was trying to, you know, have him get one over and things like that. And he never really got over that. And then it's almost like the collapses get tied to him.
Yeah.
When in reality, it was the pitching. It was the lack of depth. I mean, I've spoken to Rick Peterson.
Yeah.
Bullpen was bad and Billy Wagner got hurt. And that's one of the things that I'm a little bit more, not as bullish on Wagner as a Hall of Famer, maybe because I'm being hard on him because he's a closer. But let's also remember, you know, he tore his tendon, his Tommy John surgery in 08. But I remember there was a number of instances before 08 when I think he had some elbow issues. The whole entire time with the Mets, I'm not sure Wagner was healthy. And I was just looking at his numbers before we got on the air. They're not Edwin Diaz last year, good, but damn, they're good. So maybe I'm being a little hard on Billy Wagner there.
Yeah, and I honestly, I don't like to delve too much into why I vote for someone for the Hall of Fame or not, just because it opens me up to even these days, even the slew of like hate on Twitter and stuff like that. So
you're being brave coming on this show. You're being brave. Nah. You're my little humble abode over here. You know, we have a nice audience. We'll have all the pitchforks and fire at you there, you know?
No, I always make public who I vote for. But yeah, I do think he's, I do vote for him. Well, I did vote for him this year for the first time. I do think it's borderline, but I do believe he's going to get in. So we'll see how it we'll see how it goes. I mean, honestly, Beltran to me is the one that's it's more of a no brainer whether he has a less percentage this upcoming year or whatever than Wagner did or does or whatever. I mean, to me, Beltran, it's interesting because I still remember we were joking at the time when Beltran was a Met whether he was going to go into the Hall of Fame as a Met or a Royal. Actually, before I came on with you, I kind of even looked at the stats to see kind of
pretty close.
Yeah,
pretty
well, close. He played more games with the Mets than any other team, including the Royals. Yeah. It was 839 to 795. He had 280, 149 homers as a Met, 559 RBIs. He had 3 gold gloves as a Met. I think he had 5 of his 9 All-Star appearances as a Met. So it's a – and you know what? Excuse me. He gets a bum rap, too, for some things like – I just remember he was actually a really tough player. If you remember 2005, the first season with the Mets, he actually collides in right field with Mike Cameron, who had gotten acquired and got assigned to right field, even though it was so they had 2 center fielders and Cameron's playing right field, and they collide in San Diego in August, and Beltran fractures all kinds of bones in his face, and it for a lot of people it would have been season ending, and he was
could have been career ending. It was nasty.
He was literally back a week later. So and then even just like I know Hall of Fame, we talk about character, like for instance Omar Vizquel got obviously rightfully dinged and fell off a cliff once things came out recently about him. But I mean, Beltran was a Roberto Clemente award winner. I know he started the school in Puerto Rico. I remember writing about that. He started a school for high school age people to kind of get them on the right track and get them to Major League Baseball, because Puerto Ricans, unlike Dominicans, are subject to the draft. So you have to be in school and things like that. So Billy Wagner and I are Facebook friends and stuff. I don't want to offend him or anything like that. But if you were asking me which one more so deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, I would say Beltran, no question.
And it didn't bother you, the sign stealing, because I know a lot of people are still – you know, and I get the moral outrage. This is my opinion, not Adam's. I feel it's like, hey, who am I to judge morals? I know there's some things that are obvious moral outrage on, but I think we get too carried away with that with the Hall of Fame. And maybe it makes it fun debate. But, you know, you kind of always, you know, baseball should have known with technology that when I'm watching the game and Adam Rubin's watching the game and within seconds we're seeing something or live, if we're doing it, what made them think nobody else was doing it? I mean, come on. You know, I mean, well, baseball's typically behind all the time.
I'll give you a parallel. It's really hard to vote for the Hall of Fame. It was harder in the previous ballots because of all the steroid guys on the ballot. And people want to say to you, well, how could you vote for, I don't know who to say, like, how could you vote for A-Rod, Manny Ramirez when they clearly cheated in these people's minds? But they presume that everyone who was never caught was pure. And so why am I the one to judge whether certain guys are, the guys who got caught, I shouldn't vote for, and the guys who didn't get caught evaded it. The guys I suspected, I should vote for them because they didn't get caught. So it's kind of the same thing. And honestly, as I don't love talking about the Hall of Fame voting and stuff like that, I'm actually going to be relieved when they pull my vote in a few years. You get to vote for 10 years after you retire from writing. So unless I come back, I'm going to lose it soon. It used to be a lifetime thing. Now it's not, but I'm actually relieved in a way, because it was supposed to be fun, and it's really not fun because, I mean, I was joking earlier about getting kind of hate stuff about kind of why I vote for people and or don't vote for people. But I would, if it were just about the base pure baseball numbers and careers and stuff like that, I would embrace the debate. But it gets to kind of devolve into who cheated, who didn't cheat, that kind of stuff. And it's just not worth it to me.
It's exhausting.
Yeah, and that's a shame because it's kind of taken away from what it should be about. Adam Rubin, you guys know him, covered the Mets, Daily News, ESPN New York. If you don't mind, I don't know your ballot. I didn't see your ballot. Would you share who else you voted for? I won't tar and feather you. You know, I'll just listen, you know?
So. As I'm getting older and my memory fades, so as I'm scrolling through my phone because I have a picture of my ballot on there, I'll gladly tell you, but I just had to call it up. So I had for several years, you could only vote for 10 people as a maximum ballot for several years because there was a lot of congestion. I voted for 10. I actually didn't get to 10, I don't think, this year. I did Carlos Beltran, did Todd Helton. I do Andrew Jones. I did Manny Ramirez and Eddie Rod. So you could send your hate mail to me. Just like
I don't have a problem with those.
And I did Scott Rowland and Billy Wagner. Had Biscal on for several years and took him off. But other than that, I think it's a lot easier ballot now than it had been. I know some guys push for a Gary Sheffield that I don't happen to vote for, but now when I tweet out my ballot, I usually get compliments for the most part because it's a pretty good ballot.
I'm not just telling you that. It's a pretty good ballot. No Jeff Kent either. Jeff Kent's a tough one too because he wasn't really a second baseman, but he has, when you put him in a second base category, he's up there amongst the leaders. So I'm curious, why not Jeff Kent? Is that a curious?
As I said, I really, it's not fruitful to start going down the road. So I made that decision well, he's been on the ballot for a while now, so I'd have to go back. I don't want to give you something on the spot anyway, because I have to go back.
I understand.
But I really did research it at the time that I had to make the initial decision, and I go back every so often, kind of reconsider people. But he's not one I've really reconsidered.
Right. Now, it's you brought up Andrew Jones, and it's interesting because when I was looking at Beltran, I'm trying to find reasons to say he's not a Hall of Famer, because I feel like it's so easy with stats now to become the Hall of Very Good. Like, think about it. Adam, anybody on this ballot, I don't care what anybody says. Now, with a few exceptions, you could make an argument that they're a Hall of Famer, right? I mean, for the most part.
Yeah, they're actually a little liberal in putting people on the ballot if they've had a long career. So there are certainly guys on there that I'm going to pick on somebody. For instance, R.A. Dickey is on the
ballot. Not a Hall of Famer.
Yeah. I mean, wonderful story, whatever, knuckleball, reinvented himself, whatever. But he's on there because he played a long time. Trying to look at just some other random guys. Obviously, I skew towards the guys that, who I came close to voting for. Actually, considering is Jimmy Rollins. I wouldn't rule out, I'm going to get hate now. I'm really going to get hate now. But
That's a tough one. Yeah.
I haven't voted for him. If he picks up some momentum, I'll definitely reconsider it. And even if I just solely based it on the team to beat and coming back and beating the Mets to rehash everything, one wants to hear about bad memories, but the seven games down with 17 to play and catching the Mets. I mean, just that and how he stuck his neck out and then backed it up. Just that alone. But that Phillies era of Rollins, Utley, Howard, it was pretty tough team.
I think they stole signs too, Adam. I remember.
The Mets accused him at times, and I remember Major League Baseball at one point actually went to investigate it. Nothing became public, so I guess nothing was found.
Too good in big spots. They always found a way to get a hit. Now maybe that's just sour grapes, but it was always interesting.
But the Mets suspected it too, because I do remember. I could Google it, I guess. But I do remember writing a story about the Phillies. The Mets complained of Major League Baseball investigating the Phillies, but nothing ever came of it.
I'm curious, Andrew Jones, because as I was looking at Beltran, I'm like, if Beltran gets in eventually, and he's in a good first year, 56% is pretty good. You may have to revisit Kenny Lofton. You might have to revisit Andrew. I mean, if Andrew Jones doesn't get in, those are two guys very close when you look at it. And I never felt, Andrew Jones is a good player, but he's getting close. He's at 68%. And I didn't think Kenny Lofton was. There's some that do, with Beltran getting in, you have to look at some of these other guys and maybe on a veterans committee. It's so much more closer. It's such a hard thing. I don't envy you because you are playing with people's livelihood. I mean, not that, look, they made their money. It doesn't, but it is a prestigious thing. And you got to take it seriously. And I can tell you do. There are some that don't. But this is a tough spot you guys are in. So maybe I guess I see your point. Getting out of it is sometimes a relief. In certain
yeah. And Jones, I was just looking it up too. I think it's his sixth year on the ballot this year. I believe six. So he's got, you have 10 years up, 10 years on the ballot, as long as you keep getting at least 5%. So he's got several more times to be considered by the writers. And typically people creep upward unless something untoward comes out about you. So I wouldn't discount he's going to get voted in by the writers. Lofton, as you mentioned, is gone from the ballot. So I don't even remember what year that was. But he would have to be the veterans committee. So we'll see where that goes.
So real couple quick things before I let you go. You got a favorite memory covering the team? Doesn't have to be like something that could be just something unique. I'm curious because you always have good stories. And when I ask people those things, I'm like, something interesting's got to come up. Nothing salacious, but something interesting.
Yeah. Honestly, my favorite moment of all time with the Mets, and I still vividly remember it, is, and it's one David Wright Jose Reyes moment, and then kind of it's a parallel with Wright. It's I guess about a decade later. I still the picture that's kind of iconic, and what I observed at the time, you know, with Jose after the Mets clinched in 2006. I guess it was with Jose Reyes and David Wright chomping on the cigars on the field and celebrating and stuff like that with the and all that. And then I just remember 2015 underneath the stands at Wrigley Field, seeing David Wright outside the clubhouse and just absolutely beaming that he was going to the World Series after what was really a barren decade for the Mets. I mean, after 2006 in that NLCS, they had the two collapses, but then people probably don't forget, but they probably don't want to relieve it. They had six straight losing seasons after that. So it was
baseball purgatory.
It was eight tough years between 2006 and 2015. And just seeing the joy on his face, our careers, I guess we joke about it a little bit, or when I've spoken to him a little bit recently, or whatever over time, but our careers kind of had the same kind of arc. I started covering baseball in New York in 2001 when he was in A ball. I still remember he told me back then that, I had written like a feature story on him when there were three minor league third basemen that the Mets thought very highly of. It was David Wright, who was obviously a sandwich first round pick, so it wasn't like he was a sleeper or anything like that. But there were a couple other ones: Aaron Baldiris and Sean Bowman, also in the Mets minor league system.
I remember Sean Bowman? Yeah,
and they were all highly thought of, and no one knew exactly who was the one who was going to pan out. And I had written a feature on David Wright, who he told me was in his scrapbook, like his parents and he kept a scrapbook of all the articles. So it was like right in the front because it was one of the early articles. But just seeing the joy and knowing like what he had gone through was to me that's what I remember most. The behind the scenes stuff. I remember being at Shea Stadium for the first game back after September 11th. That was obviously an incredible moment with the Mike Piazza home run and all that. And then kind of a sort of a parallel to that, we were in Philly on Sunday Night Baseball, I think it was, when they learned that Bin Laden had been killed. Yep. And stadium. Yep. And it wasn't there were cell phones, but it wasn't the era of iPhones and internet news and all that kind of stuff. So it was spreading around the stadium kind of more word of mouth than it was kind of everyone getting alert on their phone. And just that and then chanting USA and stuff like that. So I remember that one vividly. I mean, there's so many memories that come to mind. I always love spring training too. Because everyone was upbeat in spring training and stuff like that. And then honestly, the thing I appreciated most about it was you get to see all the things that everyone else doesn't get to see. And yeah, and there are blowups with reporters and players and stuff like that. But
it was a tough time for you guys, you and the team, not just you, but even the media. It was a contentious time for a variety of reasons. I think because social media was exploding, I think it was a lot harder. You were at a very it was a weird time to watch the team. And I think it's because of the explosion of Twitter and social media and the agitation of 06. They never got over 06. They never got over.
The difference between the David Wright era players and say not to cite anyone, but like the Jacob deGrom, Noah Syndergaard, Matt Harvey era players is that the David Wright grew up kind of social media, I would say, so that the relationships were a lot different. The players who came up in the social media era were a lot more guarded, rightfully so, because there's so much more chance for things to blow up and stuff like that. So maybe they had to be a little more guarded. But honestly, I had, for the most part, I had tremendous relationships, I think, with most of the people I covered in the clubhouse. And that was the point I was making, is just that, just to be able to have the conversation, you're privileged to be able to have the conversations on a daily basis, see all the things, just kind of like sit down with the manager in the dugout before 3 hours or 2 hours before a game and just have a conversation about baseball and kind of, and also kind of, I don't want to say off the record stuff, but just kind of understand like why they're making decisions that they can't get on camera and say, but right. They kind of explain to you why things are happening. And not to be too long, but honestly, actually the most fun I ever had was with the scouts from the different teams assigned to the Mets. I would have breakfast with them every single morning during spring training and just hear great stories, hear who, like what the rumors are, but like just hear their thoughts on the different players. And sometimes they hit, sometimes they didn't hit, but I loved listening to their analysis and why they thought things about people.
And I'll tell the fans one thing. Adam here's what I always knew he was the hardest working guy. I used to go down to Trenton anytime the B-Mets were down there. And I'm going to tell you a story. You may or may not, I don't know if it's 09. I think it's 09. It was the day after Luis Castillo dropped the pop-up. I'm in Trenton and Brian Bruni was doing a rehab stint. And you were there. We were in the scrum. Bruni, you left, and that's when Bruni did the whole K-Rod imitation. And I remember getting it on audio, and I went up to you in the press box and said, you better grab this because this is about – now, here's what's funny, Adam. Twitter was just new, so I tweaked the thing out, and nobody – who the hell is Mike Silva? You know, the whole thing. Meanwhile, I get home after, you know, watch – I think Dylan G pitched or something because you're all watching these guys. And SNY picks it up like, yo, that was my thing over there, you know, but – it didn't matter. That's the whole thing. But I do remember that. But that was one of the things that you kind of pioneered that now is standard. And I mean that. You would do the minor leagues. You would write the recaps. And there was nobody else did it. Because now today there's MILB. There's you can't get away with that cottage industry anymore. But you were kind of at the beginning of that. And that is true. That is something to the testament to your work.
Well, honestly, one of the big reasons why, and it wasn't the primary reason why I did it, but one of the big reasons why I had so many sources in clubhouses and things like that was that I knew the players. When the players get to New York, there's 30 media in the clubhouse, newspapers, TV stations, yeah. Bloggers, things like whatever, things like that. And they don't, they have to be guarded. They come in there. A lot of them come from, they hadn't been in a media market or environment like that before. And it's like deer in the headlights kind of thing where they don't know who they could trust. But I knew the guys 3 or 4 years before most of them, most of the other reporters did, because I would go to minor league games nonstop on my off days and things like that, whether it was Brooklyn or I would make going to go and getting when the Mets were playing the Marlins, get over to St. Lucie or whatever, watch some Florida State League games, get to Binghamton. Even like it was tough when the Mets were in the Pacific Coast League, but I would get to as many AAA games as I could, especially when they're in Buffalo. It was great. Go to like Scranton, Wilkes-Barre or something like that and, right. And catch up with them. So I did a weekly minor league feature on a player every week, and it wasn't always the best player on the team. Right. It was just whoever had an interesting story, and then I'd do minor league notes, and every day I would do game recaps of all the minor league games, which elongated my day, but it certainly was advantageous in building relationships. And I used to drive the Mets, not to be too much about myself, but I used to drive the Mets nuts because, you know, when someone's going on the DL, they want to, or just when they're having a player transaction, they want to keep it quiet till the next day and like activate the guy an hour before the game. And literally they would call down to the AAA team to promote somebody. And like 15 minutes later, I'd be tweeting who's getting called up. And they would
drive them crazy. Yeah.
The Mets would go crazy about it. I mean, literally crazy about it. But when you know all the AAA and AA players, you know all their families and you know all their agents, stuff like that. It wasn't even like one deep throat or anything like that. You knew all the guys and they trusted you. And it was kind of harmless in the grand scheme of life, the information. It wasn't like they were sharing some thing that's going to affect a trade or anything like that. So it was amusing to me, but the Mets didn't take it as amusing a lot of times.
Now, I will say one other thing. Adam is a big Islanders fan because there was a period of time when the old Coliseum, I went to like 2 or 3 Islanders games, and every time I went there, I'd run into you, and I'm like, geez, what are you, at the same schedule? Are you going to UBS? Are you still watching the Isles? We'll wrap it up on that because
To kind of back, my parents had shared season tickets when I was growing up with another family, so I still remember at Nassau Coliseum, we were section 210, row E, seats 7 and 8. So we were religiously go to games when I was younger. And that was talking about the Mets having 8 Baron years. The Islanders had a lot. Long time. the new Ice Age was like, it was crazy. I've only been to one game at UBS Arena, and I don't think you would mind me sharing it. I was actually in Jeff Wilpon's box there. we still keep in touch.
Still keep in touch with the band? Do you keep in touch with Jeff? Do you keep in touch with Omar? Do you keep in touch with all the principals from, you know, those years? Because it's like, bygones are bygones at this point, I would think, you know?
It's funny. Well, I have nothing against Omar or anything like that. Jeff Wilpon, I actually do keep in touch with. Not that we're going out on Saturday nights or anything like that, but we probably exchange an email or call once every couple months or so just to say hello and see how everyone's doing. David Wright a little more infrequently than that, but every so often I'll email him. He might email me once in a while, that kind of stuff. Actually, David, when I was at NYIT, came to a baseball practice and was very generous with his time with the kids. So other than that, it's funny. A lot of the guys who were either fringy players or minor leaguers are the ones I'm closest to. So like I'm Facebook friends with just about every Mets minor leaguer of all time who didn't make it to the major leagues. So those are the guys, but those are always the guys I really enjoy talking to more than anything too, and had great stories and were just kind of real people. Not to name drop or anything. We don't need to name drop or anything like that, but like a lot of those guys are the ones I still sort of keep in touch with. I mean, it was a business relationship at the time, but kind of I'm out of it now, so I can't do much damage. So we chat.
And, you know, David Wright, even with the injury, his numbers are not Hall of Fame. I think he falls short. I think it'd be tough to put him in, but not far off. And I watched his whole career, and I knew he was good, and I think he was another one. And I think it's part of 06 that there was always that feeling he's not clutch. Like, it's weird because Beltran, right, that 07 thing, I think, followed them. Maybe it's a New York thing. And I think with Beltran, it kind of hurts him a little bit in the New York perspective with the Hall of Fame. But Wright, I think maybe the younger fans appreciate him more because of what happened to him. But I know there was a bunch. And when you cover the team, Wright's not clutch. He's not good. He's not a leader. And that was probably all silly when you look back at it. But it's interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, I mean, not being a leader is certainly silly. I wouldn't doubt that ultimately he may get in just because of who he was and the nice guy that he was. And that he might trickle up over time and get over over 75%. It's probably a big parallel to, say, Don Mattingly with the Yankees, whose career was actually cut short by a back injury, too, that I think it might have actually been the same exact spinal stenosis.
Yep.
It probably is going to be the same fate for David Wright as Don Mattingly. I mean, I'm hoping to hold on to a Hall of Fame vote long enough so that I can vote for David. And normally you would do it kind of just pure analytical and whether he deserves it or not. I'm not going to be impartial on that one. I'm going to vote for him no matter. Not that I don't think he's a Hall of Famer, but I even if it were marginal, I'd be voting for him. I'm sure a lot of guys with the players they covered in their market, if it's borderline, they're going to vote for it, but I'm going to vote for him in a second.
Give LIU a plug. Now I know the LIU, I grew up in Brooklyn, so I know LIU Brooklyn. So I remember LIU Brooklyn. They used to have, when I was in college, had great beer parties on Thursday. All right. My friend of mine went there. And I will admit I got a few free beers at LIU Brooklyn, but that's not why you should go to LIU. So give them a plug. You've been generous with your time. And you actually even work for Stony Brook, which is a stone's throw. I'm right up Nichols Road a little way. So you've been in the college game a while now, you know?
Yeah, no, it's so scary. We were talking about like Beltran's free agency in 2004, 2005. I'm thinking to myself, that was almost 20 years ago, which is where the time go.
It was 15 years ago. I interviewed you after opening day on that dopey radio station. Here we are again. So time flies when you're having fun.
But as far as LIU, in the past, people may be familiar with LIU Post as a D2 school, LIU Brooklyn, the Blackbirds is a D1 school. 5 years ago or 4 years ago, the athletic programs unified. So it's all one division, one program now with 38 teams called the Sharks. So primarily the indoor sports like basketball, volleyball, the pool sports are in Brooklyn, and a good bulk of the teams are out on Long Island at the LIU Post campus. So we have out here the baseball and the baseball team, the lacrosse teams, the football team, the soccer teams. Actually, the Islanders facility, Northwest Health Ice Center in East Meadow, hosts our hockey teams, our men's and women's hockey teams. It's been really exciting this year with the hockey. The men's program is playing a juggernaut schedule because they're an independent, beat its first ever ranked opponent, beat Ohio State this year, took Northeastern, which was the top 10 team, to overtime, took Quinnipiac, a top 10 team, to overtime. So it's been a lot of fun. And honestly, I really, really, really enjoy college athletic communications because it's great because you get to create the content, like we mentioned at the beginning, but you're part of the team as well. As much as I always tell people, when I used to speak with journalism classes, I used to tell them that my brother coaches high school basketball, as people who follow me on Twitter probably know.
Yes, I remember that. I remember that.
Used to be MacArthur. Now it's West Hempstead. So we're all West Hempstead fans now.
You're West Hempstead.
But the same year that the Mets made the World Series in 2015, my brother had taken over the high school basketball team at MacArthur, and they won the school's first basketball playoff game in 10 years. And honestly, for me, I was so much more emotional about my brother's team winning a high school basketball playoff game than I was about the Mets making the World Series, because I had watched how much it went into it. I helped out a lot. Where the Mets, you're chronicling someone else's moment when you're an independent journalist. Sure. So to make it contemporaneous with what we're talking about now, I mean, when you're on the athletic communication staff or when you work for the university athletic department, yeah, you're not on the field during games, but when the team makes the College World Series or the team makes the NCAA tournament, you were part of that to a certain extent. You've seen all the behind the scenes things, you're traveling with them. So it's so much fun to be on this side of it where you get to see all the behind the scenes things, all the decisions being made that you would never see if you were a reporter covering a team as an independent journalist. So very much fun to me. I've learned a lot. Like with ESPN, obviously I hosted a radio show, used to be in front of the camera, even though I was primarily a print reporter for ESPN.com. But when I get to NYIT and now even through now with LIU, I'm overseeing the broadcast. So I had to learn how to do a broadcast, and we built up the broadcast at LIU now where we're sending the hockey games to ESPN Plus. A year ago before we started, it was one camera broadcast going to just some conference portal or whatever. And now we're doing 5-6 camera broadcasts going to ESPN Plus that are really sophisticated. So it's been fun learning how to build a broadcast, creating content for websites. I do a lot of photography. People may remember I used to shoot.
I do remember photos. That.
Yeah, I've gotten better equipment over the years and shoot a lot of the sports photography. Like if you were trying to shoot Mets spring training or Mets ball game and you walk onto the field or whatever during a practice, they'd probably shoot you or tackle you or something like that.
You didn't have the right press pass. You didn't have the right press pass. That's whereas, why you have the photographer press pass. That's the
important. But I could literally walk up to the batting cage or into the batting cage and take a photo of somebody and things like that that you just can't do when you're covering a professional team. So it's so rewarding that I would encourage a lot of journalists to get into this because it's a lot of the same skills with much more reward.
All right, I got to let you go, but UBS, can you tolerate UBS over the Coliseum? I haven't been there. A friend of mine went to Pavarotti, said the parking stunk. Parking's expensive if you want to get $169 concierge parking. What do you think? There's Islanders fans in the audience. Can you tolerate UBS or do you want the barn back?
Well, I mean, proximity-wise, I love Nassau Coliseum. But I will say I was spoiled the one day. I mentioned who hosted me the one day. So I kind of had parking right next to the building and some other amenities that probably a lot of people didn't have that day.
That's going to get you more in trouble with the fan base than your Hall of Fame vote. That's what I was
saying. I don't know if you wanted me to say that either. So that's why I'm not saying the name again. But
that's right. Hey, listen, thank you again. I've always appreciated you. You've always been a good guy. You've always been able to be accommodating. LIU, if you're looking to go to college, Adam Rubin's the guy to go recruit you to go to LAU. Adam,
I need interns. If you're in college anywhere in the area, I need interns. So
you need interns, so we'll do that. But thanks a lot, my friend. I'll say Happy New Year, even though it's past the threshold. And let's keep in touch, all right?
Awesome. Thank you, Michael.
The Talking Mets podcast is available on many outlets, but the most popular is Apple Podcast. Hi, I'm Mike Silva, the host of the Talking Mets podcast, and I encourage you to leave a review about the program on Apple. Just rate it 1 to 5 stars, hopefully a 5 because why wouldn't you? And then if you have time, leave a review. It helps the podcast continue to grow and encourages others to take a listen. You can also email me at MikeSilva@TalkingMetsPodcast.com. No G, TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Hope to hear from you soon and enjoy the rest of the show. You enjoyed the double episode version of the Talking Mets podcast. Look, divisional football Sunday. I know that some of your Giants fans are still recovering from that game last night. Maybe you're out there watching some football. I know it's a hard time of the year to get people engaged in baseball if you're a hardcore football fan, but we have a pretty hardcore audience. And this was kind of our final really our only one of those January, lull of January. The football takes over. The baseball hot stove really gets cooler because the musical chairs is just those component and roundabout players that are out there. So you don't really – look, you really want to have a Tommy Pham show? Is that what you really want? I don't think so. So we do the Hall of Fame show. The Mets made some big announcements for their Hall of Fame. So what better way to do it than to celebrate it with a two-part episode? Adam brought back tons of memories. I think that that era of Mets baseball, now that we're basically 15 or 16 years away from it, it's amazing how time flies, because I started this media journey in the middle of all of that. And that's the crazy part. And I remember so much. And maybe as we get closer to the if Beltran gets in, which he won't, you know, maybe that's something that we can talk about again. Now, next year on the Hall of Fame ballot, in addition to Adrian Beltre and Joe Mauer, I think Mauer will be an interesting conversation, I'm sure, at the catching position. But Beltre, to me, is the one that stands out as a Hall of Famer. Wright and Reyes are on the Hall of Fame ballot. I don't think either is a Hall of Famer. But I'll tell you what, you know, Wright was every bit the way going there. You know, if Wright was able to stay healthy another 3 or 4 years and then have his back issues, would have been a much more interesting conversation. I say no to Wright in the Hall of Fame. His number will be retired. I have a feeling now that he's Hall of Fame eligible in the next couple of years, Wright will be retired. I also think David has to get out of his system, his career. I have a feeling that it ended, obviously not the way he wanted. And, you know, sometimes it's hard for a player to come back and see their number hoisted up on the wall when in their mind they still could play in some way, shape, or form. So, you know, it'll be interesting how that plays. But I think as you listen to Adam, I think looking back and having some memories and looking at that era of Mets baseball, which led to baseball purgatory under Sandy Alderson, and probably, you know, probably in some ways might be more disappointing than the 87 to 91. Hard to debate because it was always the door opened and closed pretty quickly. And there's a lot more to that era. You know, I have some intimate knowledge, you know, having talked to those around the team. The team probably wasn't as good as we thought. And, you know, unfortunately, there was a lot of stuff going on in the background. Omar Minaya, as I said, was a great scout, not so great executive. But that's another story for another day. So hopefully you enjoyed Adam Rubin. I had a lot of fun. And no, I wasn't going to get into the Omar stuff. It doesn't matter. Like he said, it's over is over. You could see why Omar and the Mets probably hated him, because he was good at his job. I used to see him at minor league ballparks all the time on his day off. I mean, how many writers do that now? I mean, now I think they would take their day off and I don't blame him. Look, it's a hard job. But if you really want to make an impact in this business, you got to hustle. And sometimes that hustle is sweat equity on time off that you're not getting paid. That's why it's such a hard job. That's why it's such a hard industry. And it's getting harder because the pay is so bad and it's so hard to stand out. But Adam was a pioneer. You had Mets Blog and Matt Cerrone at the time. And Adam, from a mainstream media perspective, you know, the recaps and some of the things you see with the minor leagues and how the beat writers approach their job, he was a pioneer on that. No doubt about it. So it was really fun catching up with Adam. I didn't know if he would come on. I reached out to him earlier in the week, and he was gracious enough. And I had a lot of fun talking to him. And you heard his ballot. You heard his experience covering Beltran and the guys. And a little bit different. Had a little bit different take than I did on some of the players that, you know, at that point and what have you. You know, I left Jeff Kent off my ballot this year. And I'm kind of regretting that. And I'll wrap up with this. I think Jeff Kent should be a Hall of Famer. He should be on the ballot. I talked about it a little bit, and I regret. I kind of botched the initial foray. And here's what I'll say. Jeff Kent, I'm on the fence, and I'm leaning no, but I may change my mind. From 1995 to 2005, he was better than Biggio. He was better than Olimar in war, both in Fangraphs and Baseball Reference. He played 85% of his games at the position during that time. And you look at his numbers, he's right there with Jackie Robinson and Ryan Sandberg. He has an MVP, you know, an average of 28 homers, 109 RBIs, and a 136 OPS plus. I think I have to relook at that. I lean no on this. I didn't even get into him on the initial Hall of Fame ballot. Bad job by me, and I'll take the L on that. I'm going to stick with him not being on the ballot, but I may examine him a little bit more. And I'm not opposed to him being on the ballot. I'm not opposed to him getting into the Hall of Fame. And a huge Mets connection. I mean, they traded for David Cohn. And, you know, who would have thought that the Hall of Famer in that trade, the Mets would have got a Hall of Famer back in that trade. They did. Or a borderline Hall of Famer. And they gave up on him a little bit too soon. But he's an example of a guy that probably played better in a market like San Francisco, like Houston, like L.A., later in his career, than New York. You know, he's an intense guy and the media scrutiny. And let's face it, the team was so dysfunctional and bad in 92 and 93. And I say this all the time, a big difference Ryan Thompson actually talked about it. And I know one of you guys reached out and asked me what podcast it was on. I'm trying to find that. I can't find it. It's years ago. But Ryan Thompson was on a podcast and said it was so hard coming into that clubhouse as a young player. And Kent had to go through it. You don't have the mature veteran leadership. You're in a bad situation. You're in a bad media situation. You're playing for a losing team. A lot of bad habits come from that. And maybe Jeff Kent needed to get out of there to get rid of those habits. But it would have been interesting to see him, if Bobby Valentine was his manager and he stuck around, how the Mets could have evolved with Kent in the lineup. It would have been interesting to see. So anyway, I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the two-part edition of the Talking Mets podcast, Hall of Fame Talking Mets podcast. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media. And you can show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. No G, Mike Silva at talkingmetspodcast.com. Also want to thank the good folks over at the Fansided Podcasting Network, as well as risingapple.com. Check me out on Instagram, Talking Mets No G. All right, have a great week. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday, and get ready for the Hall of Fame vote. What is it, on Tuesday? Till then, take care, everybody.